From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com. You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Nancy Pelosi is the minority leader in the House of Representatives, and that makes her one of the most powerful Democrats in Washington. And that despite the fact that she's only been in elected office for 19 years. She's campaigning for Democratic victories in this fall's midterm elections, and she joins me here in the studio today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Pleasure to be here.
You represent a district in California, but isn't Maryland your home state?
Yes, good research. I was born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland. When I was born, my father was in the Congress of the United States, and from first grade to when I went to college, he was the mayor of Baltimore.
So later your brother was.
And then my brother was mayor of Baltimore later. So we were early on taught how public service was a noble calling and that we had to do something to give back to society.
And I imagine growing up in a household where politics was the main topic of discussion had a real effect. When you were a kid, did you imagine that you would follow in your father's footsteps?
No, I was raised in an Italian-American Catholic family in the Little Italy in Baltimore, Maryland. In my era, it wasn't something that I even would have thought of as a little girl. But I always was a staunch Democrat right from the start, and I thought my parents were working on the side of the angels and what they were doing. But I never envisioned running for public office myself.
And your brother even got into a bit of trouble for having a certain amount of integrity as a mayor.
Yeah.
He got caught up in the racial politics of a border state.
Well, it wasn't trouble. He just decided not to run again for re-election. He was very popular when he ran the first time.
But he was a civil rights advocate,
and the city was divided. But to this day, he is so well respected by the black community for the courage he demonstrated in his public service, whether it's equal accommodations and restaurants and housing, whatever it was. It was a transitional time, late 60s, early 70s.
You didn't run under the family name, and you ran in a state as far away as you could get because you wanted to disassociate yourself?
No, because my husband was born and raised in San Francisco, and that's where we lived, but not before, as newlyweds living in Manhattan, where four of our five children were born. Only one was born in California, our daughter Alexandra, and she now lives in Manhattan.
The well-known filmmaker.
The well-known filmmaker, mother-to-be soon, and she and her husband, Mihail. But in any case, no, my husband, when I went to California, of course, pretty soon I would have five children, and raising my children was obviously my major focus. And after they were raised, and Alexandra was on her way to senior year in high school, then I had the opportunity to run for Congress.
Well, Barbara Boxer is from Brooklyn. California's governor is from Austria. Was Richard Nixon the only native-born Californian to hold a major office?
No. But it is a land of opportunity for all. But my husband does take great pride in being born and raised in San Francisco. So those natives, rare as they may be, take pride.
And you, as you said, waited until 1987 when the youngest of your five kids was a senior in high school. Did you believe that a mother's first responsibility is to raise her children?
Well, let me say yes, I do.
Because Republicans often go after Democrats on issues like that.
Well, they? I think that, yes, I do think a parent's responsibility is to raise their children. I think that any way that people figure that out for themselves, whether as a working mom or as an at-home mom, is up to them and what is right for them in their own personal and economic situation. I'm in awe of these young women, including I have four daughters and one son, my own daughters, and how they balance their lives with their small children. But it is, when I was sort of asked to run for this seat. It was a very competitive race that I was in. It was by no means a foregone conclusion that I would win. I went to my daughter, Alexandra, who was going into senior year in high school, and said, you know, I wish this were 1 year later when you were off. The other four were already in college. And I said, do you mind if I would do this? I'd be gone Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, come home Thursday from Washington. She said, Mother, get a life. And I did. A continuation of my life as a mom, but to look after many more children than my own.
Well, what led them to ask you to run for that office? You didn't start as alderman and work your way up.
No, but I was active in the Democratic Party. And of course, that was volunteer, and I became chair of the California Democratic Party. So I had worked to elect Democrats throughout the state of California for a long time. And again, I could always be home by 3 o'clock because it was a volunteer position by the time the children came home from school. But then just as it turns out, well, it's a story all itself. The congresswoman who had taken ill, she knew that she was terminally ill, but she told me that she wanted me to run and would endorse me and this and that. And I really had never even thought in terms of running for office. She said, you love the issues. You want to talk about the future all the time. This is the venue to do it. So I did, and here I am.
Nancy Pelosi, House Minority Leader. She's my guest on the Leonard Lopate Show today. You've said that you were raised as a practicing Roman Catholic. Are you still a religious person?
I am.
So how do you balance your faith with your political beliefs? For example, you've been consistently pro-choice and a supporter of gay marriage, for example. Haven't those sorts of moral values issues hurt the Democrats in recent years and also inspired some people in the Catholic Church to even talk about excommunicating politicians who vote the way you vote?
I see them as completely congruent, as connected. The way I was raised in the Catholic Church is that we were all God's children and all worthy of respect, and that we couldn't tolerate discrimination of any kind. And so I find it very easy. I mean, it's not a political expedient for me. It's just the way it is that I support gay people to have gays, lesbians, whatever, to have whatever opportunity they want to find their own happiness and grow their own families. As far as a woman's right to choose, I was taught when I was little, and I believed it, and it holds me in good stead now in my own conscience, that we're all given a free will and have our responsibilities, that, and we have to answer for that. So it's completely consistent to me to be pro-choice and to be pro-gay rights.
And what happens when people in the clergy, whether it's the Catholic clergy or others, tell you that that's inconsistent with your religious beliefs?
It isn't inconsistent with mine. It may be inconsistent with theirs. But I'm a regular churchgoer. I love the church. I value my faith. I do some of my best thinking on Sundays in church. This week, however, I was at Riverside Church, not a Catholic church, but it counted as my obligation because I was inspired beyond words by Reverend Forbes there. But, I don't know where anybody decided that they would decide what was consistent with my religious beliefs for me. But I love the church, and I think it's just a matter of time. I'm used to quoting St. Augustine in terms of the church. So if they want to talk about being consistent with the church's teaching, I said to my colleagues, in fact, last week when we had the debate on the floor about the minimum wage, which hasn't been raised in 9 years, I said in his latest encyclical, his first and only encyclical, our new pope, it's called God is Love. And in the encyclical, he quotes St. Augustine when he says this. He was talking about the responsibility of elected officials and people are responsible for government. And the Pope quotes St. Augustine as saying, any government that is not formed to promote justice is just a bunch of thieves. Now, this is a Pope quoting a saint. And I told my colleagues, I said, and then the Pope himself goes on to say, and how do you define justice? How do you describe it? How do you define it? He said, in doing so, you must beware of the danger. He warned of the danger of the dazzling blindness of special interests and power. So, you know, if we're supposed to promote justice, certainly raising the minimum wage without giving a tax break to the wealthiest people in America is the one good place to start without being a gang of thieves, as St. Augustine said, as quoted by the Pope.
But when the Republicans linked the tax break to the raising the minimum wage, they kind of seized the debate, didn't they? They undermined what the Democrats were hoping to do, and that's something that they've been able to do all along, whether it's coming up with phrases like cut and run or doing something like this. Why do you think is it because, as some people have suggested, Republicans have developed all these think tanks over the last 30 or 40 years that have given them some kind of a head start in the
debate? Well, it gave them a head start, but technology has helped us leapfrog over a good deal of that 30 years of think tanks. As far as cut and run is concerned, I think that aptly describes what most of them are doing as far as President Bush is concerned. They are cutting and running from him, so they ought not use that phrase. It's too close to home for them. And as Democrats have been fighting for a minimum wage now for 9 years, $5.15 an hour for 9 years, while the purchasing power has gone down, the cost of everything, price at the pump, food, everything has gone up. And so we made the issue too hot for them to handle. They're philosophically opposed to a minimum wage, and the only way they could swallow that bitter pill that the minimum wage is for them is to give an $800 billion tax cut to the 7,500 wealthiest families in America. But just a bunch of thieves, I think St. Augustine would say.
Well, you have made statements like that and gotten some people upset.
Yes.
When you call the Republican-run Congress the most corrupt Congress in history.
In history.
You must have known that would bring down the wrath of every Republican pundit on your head.
Well, it's just the truth. And we're determined, Harry Reid and I have put forth our honest leadership, open government proposal to turn this Congress from the most corrupt and closed Congress in history to the most open and honest Congress.
But isn't it always just who's in power?
No.
For example, there were congressional scandals when the Democrats controlled Congress. Jim Wright, Dan Rustenkowski, and there were any number of others. That's kind of like the nature of political power, isn't
it? No. Well, I know you're challenging me, Leonard. You couldn't possibly really believe that. But in any case, here's the thing. There have been personal indiscretions along the way. The two you happen to mention do not involve any way a cost to the taxpayer. What we're talking about here is not individual cases that you might mention, but a systematic enterprise. The Washington Post called what was happening in Washington now a criminal enterprise operating out of Leader DeLay's office, now out of the Republican leader's office. And it is that corruption has a cost to the taxpayer. These bills of the energy bill, the prescription drug bill, born of corruption, behind closed doors with no answers to the American people, where consumers paying the price at the pump, and the seniors, middle-income seniors, will pay more at the pharmacy for their prescription drugs, and the list goes on. But it's pervasive, and it's systemic, and it comes from the Republican leadership. If we have any indiscretions in our party, we deal with them, as I did with the recent case.
With William Jefferson, who you insisted actually be removed from the Ways and Means Committee, even though he has not been indicted for anything.
Well, he's not indicted, but an ethical standard is not a standard that is proven guilty in a court of law. I mean, I think we should be held to a higher standard, and I think having $90,000 in your freezer, unless you can prove that the tooth fairy brought it, is a reason to say, until this is cleared up, we don't think you should have that privilege.
There has been one conviction for corruption, and that's Randy Duke Cunningham from your home state.
Right.
But it's interesting that—
A Republican.
It's interesting that in the election to fill the seat, the Democrat didn't win. Another conservative Republican won.
Well, she came very close. I mean, he would not have won, but she came very close. It was a competitive race, and she got the second highest number of votes of any Democratic nominee in California, except me. I mean, I think that was quite an accomplishment for a first-time-out person in one of the most conservative districts in California compared to my district, which is one of the most progressive. which I'm proud to represent.
My guest is Nancy Pelosi, who is the minority leader of the House of Representatives of the United States. Some people think she will be the majority leader.
Speaker.
Right, Speaker of the House, right.
Says she immodestly.
Yes, Speaker of the House after the next election. We will see. We will take a little break and come back with more. We're back with Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader. How do you deal with Democrats who don't go along with party policy? For example, when 15 Democrats, many of them progressives, voted for the Republican-sponsored CAFTA bill last summer.
I don't like it at all. But I'm proud to say that 100% of the Democrats, House and Senate, are behind our new direction for America. A new direction for all Americans, not the privileged few, and that we rolled that out in unity with Democrats being focused, disciplined, organized, and, as I said, unified. It's a new direction that will make America safer, our economy fairer, health care more accessible, opportunity for higher education broadened, we declare our energy independence, and guarantee a dignified retirement. We do this all in a fiscally sound way, no new deficit spending, pay as you go, audit the books, where is the money? So we're united where we need to be. I was disappointed on that because I thought it was an important vote. But all of our members on the Democratic side are independent representatives of their districts.
Two of them were New York politicians, Gregory Meeks and Ed Towns, and they said that opponents of CAFTA were being racist.
That's completely not the case, but I don't want to characterize the motivation of my colleagues and what they might say, even though they are questioning our motivation. This was about lifting American workers as well as not exploiting workers in other countries. This was about core values, about workers' rights, and about protecting the environment. These are our democratic principles. We are free traders. We are fair traders. We know the value of trade to our economy. We don't want workers exploited as well as the environment as well, and that was our fight.
Is there more discipline in the House, or do you have equivalents of people like Senators Ben Nelson and Joe Lieberman who have crossed party lines on some key votes?
We have the highest rate of unity in any time since the 50s, since they've been measuring this, higher than any time under my leadership, says she immodestly. But Democrats are working together because we have come together around our core values. We've established our priorities. We want them to be in sync with the concerns of the American people, relevant to their lives. That's why it's about jobs and health care and education and the safety of our neighborhoods. It's why it's about a dignified retirement and the cost of energy and what that means to the economic security of their families. So I'm very proud of the unity we have. I call my House Democrats the greatest collection of intellect, integrity, and idealism of any organization you can name. And if you join that with the Democrats in the Senate, it's even a bigger group with that title.
But other people have seen this as part of the partisanship, the great divide that has developed in recent years. And where two sides harden their lines, and we don't see the kind of bipartisan work that we have seen in the past.
We should. And one of the principles, I've sent a letter to Speaker Hastert this summer, and I sent it two summers ago, saying no matter who of us becomes the speaker next time, and I'm hoping and praying that Democrats will win this time, but for reasons beyond who is the speaker. I sent him our principles for a new democratic time. There's no reason to have this fierce partisanship in the Congress. It's one thing to advocate on the outside, but when we go there, we have to get the job done for the American people. And so what I said is, if I am Speaker, I will call for bipartisan administration of the House where every voice is heard. I, as leader, nor any one of my members in the Democratic caucus, cannot have a bill on the floor. They just don't allow it. That's not the vision of our founders or the sacrifice of our troops. And it's not about the aspiration of our children. We have to do it in a way that is bipartisan, that has every voice be heard, not just those represented by the majority. And I think this is something the American people expect and deserve.
Although we have heard some Republicans say that some of the things they're doing has to do with punishing Democrats for excesses in the past. What about the other way? If Democrats can take over control at least of one of the houses of Congress, will they at all want to get back for the way that Republicans have been conducting business in recent years?
Well, first of all, their charge that this is just getting even for them is not valid. They can't point to anything similar to this, where you pull up all the ladders and say there's no way any of you can reach a place where you can speak on the floor, introduce a bill, speak on, about your bill on the floor. What I have said is, though, this is I can't answer for what they're talking about in the past. It certainly is not valid. Their point isn't valid. But say that they were treated in a way that they did not like. I'm not answering for that. I'm talking about the future. And in the future, starting in January, bipartisan administration, and this is my pledge, and this will be the first rule that we introduce. It will be about integrity to break the link between lobbyists and legislation, drain the swamp in Washington, clean it up. Takes a woman to clean the place up, I guess. Break that link. Lobbying reform. Secondly, it will be about civility. Bipartisan administration of the House. Third will be about fiscal discipline. Pay as you go, no deficit spending, and audit the books. So those are the rules of engagement that we would propose. That's our pledge. We will make it a rule of the House that bipartisanship should prevail and spell out how it would take form.
But isn't it a very different thing to lead a party that's expected to create rather than to oppose?
Oh, this is I keep telling my colleagues this every day. Get ready. We are going to be making law, God willing, if we do our work. Of course, the election is 98 days away, and we have 100 political lifetimes between now and the election. So we're not overconfident or arrogant about our prospects. We just know that today we're double-digit ahead in the polls. If the election were held today, would you vote for a Democrat or Republican? And that's good, but today is not the election. And we have to work very hard to win the confidence of the American people. But we're ready to fight for that, prepared to govern, and I'm certain to make people proud.
Nancy Pelosi is my guest. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Today's New York Times reports that you've signed a group letter along with a dozen other Democratic leaders, including Harry Reid, that calls for a phased redeployment of troops in Iraq by the end of the year. Hasn't the Pentagon just announced an increase of troops in Iraq?
That's why we wrote the letter, Leonard. The impetus for our letter was twofold. One is they first said they were going to decrease, they were going to redeploy out of Iraq. And then they announced that they were sending more troops into Baghdad. Second point is that all of this is having a depleting effect on our military. So some of our biggest hawks on the Democratic side, certainly in our House, Jack Murtha and Ike Skelton, are very concerned about the impact on our military readiness, how we in this country are able to respond to threats to our security wherever they occur in the world. And so we sent that letter to the president saying, stay the course, it hasn't worked. It's time for a new direction in Iraq. And that new direction is about responsible redeployment of our troops. It's about dialoguing with the leadership of Iraq that it's their time to take charge of their security and their reconstruction, and that they have a responsibility to calm the political divisions there by amending their constitution and by disarming the militia. And then the third point is to internationalize it with diplomacy in the region, especially to help with the reconstruction and the stability of Iraq. This was a very strong statement on House and Senate Democratic leadership to the president saying, stay the course, isn't working. We need a new direction.
You called Jack Murtha a hawk, and on the whole, he has been in the past, but he's become one of the doves as far as the situation in Iraq is concerned. In recent months, many members of Congress have said that if they knew during the run-up to the war in Iraq what they know now, they wouldn't have supported it. As far as you know, did most of the people in Congress actually believe there were lots of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
I don't know.
I remember the debate at the time, and there were a lot of people here in at least in the New York press, who were saying, the evidence doesn't really seem to point to that.
Well, I was a senior Democrat on the Intelligence Committee in the House at the time. There's a gang of four, senior House Democrat and Republican, senior Senate House. The senior Democrat in the Senate was Senator Bob Graham of Florida. And as those gang of four, we have access to more intelligence than any of the members. There's a requirement under law to be informed by the administration. I said before the vote, the intelligence does not support the threat. And people said to me, are you calling the president a liar?
The Democrats as well as Republicans?
No, the press. Mm-hmm. The press. And some Republicans. Are you calling the president a liar? I said, I'm telling you that this, I've read it all. I understand it. The intelligence does not support the threat. So I was very proud that 60% of the House Democrats voted against giving the president the authority to go forward. The case was not the same in the Senate, even though Senator Bob Graham of Florida, not a San Francisco Democrat, if somebody wanted to characterize my vote that way, voted against the war.
But Hillary Rodham Clinton continues to say that that's a reason that she supports the effort, continued effort in Iraq. And she's a New York Democrat. You don't know. You can't talk.
Well, I don't know any. You know, I don't question anybody's motivation as to what their vote is. I can only answer for my own. But all Democrats in the House and Senate agree with the law, which says the laws passed this spring in the Congress that says that 2006 must be a year of significant transition in Iraq, where the Iraqi government takes responsibility for its government and for its security. And I don't know of any objection from any Democratic senator to that initiative. And that is the law. That is in the law. It's not just our agenda proposal. It's in the law.
Washington Post correspondent Thomas E. Ricks was here last week to talk about his book, Fiasco. But one of his main criticisms of the situation in Iraq is that there have never been enough troops there. So his criticism is coming from another side.
Right. Well, the question of whether you go in or not and if there's justification, if the reason to go in was legitimate, is one question. Once you decide to go in, you have to decide to go in to win. And I fully agree that this administration did not listen to General Shinseki, who told him if you go in, this is the number of troops that are required. He was, shall we say, ignored and disdained for making that suggestion. So right now it's a question of not whether we should have gone in or not. The question is, how is this war being conducted? And also, what about the money? So we've lost the lives of our precious young people, over 2,500 now. We've 20,000 injured, half of them with permanent injury. It'll be $1 trillion if the war ended today. Loss in lives, limbs, loss in dollars, lost in reputation. And they can't account for the money. The Republican administration, cannot account for the money that they've put into Iraq. And I think that's the debate you're going to hear in the summer, and that Senator Clinton, I'm sure, will be in the forefront of is how to account for the conduct of this war financially and in every other way.
And you've been saying on the show that a Democratic Congress would reduce government spending. Do you mean mostly through Iraq? Because the cost of supporting government programs that Democrats traditionally support usually leads to more government spending.
Well, what I'm saying is that our new direction is about doing what we're doing in a fiscally sound way, that the investments we make, for example, in education, nothing brings more money to the public till, to the treasury of federal, state, or local government than educating our people. That is an investment with a payoff. And we're also saying that these tax cuts that were given to the high end, to the wealthiest people in our country, are largely what is responsible for the deficit. And we are in deep deficit, and it's only growing. And so what we're saying, when Democrats come in, no new deficit spending, pay as you go, audit the books. 18 of 23 government agencies cannot take an audit. The taxpayer is not being served by this. So we're saying, let's get what we need from government, not just waste money that cannot be accounted for, whether it's at home, whether it's in Katrina, or whether it's in Iraq. And also that certain investments that we make in innovation, in education, in alternative energy, really grow our economy and bring more money to the Treasury. We have to think in a more dynamic way than in old ways of thinking about it.
Most of the projections are that the Democrats will win back one of the houses of Congress, perhaps two, but most likely just one. So what will that mean? Will that just lead to more gridlock?
Well, I'm hoping for two.
Well,
because, you know, everybody who's saying, what are we going to do to stop George Bush? Well, there's a simple answer. Vote Democratic in the congressional elections. Turn out so that we can have oversight over what this administration is doing. Up until now, there's Republican Congress, House and Senate has been a rubber stamp for President Bush every step of the way. They have been abdicated their responsibility of oversight, of oversight of everything, of the policy and of the spending. So we will have that oversight, one house or two. But I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic that if the public hears our message of new direction, that we will win both houses. And our victory in the House will help win the Senate as well. As you know, Chuck Schumer from New York is doing a great job as the chairman of that effort to win the Senate. Rahm Emanuel is our chairman in the House, and he's great as well. From Illinois, but I'm not accepting one. I think that it would be great if we had two, and we're going to work very hard to achieve that goal.
Some members of your party, like Barney Frank, have said that however good a politician you are, your speaking style can be frustrating. Has he talked to you about that?
He told me it was out of context.
Oh. That's what people always say.
Nancy. I know. I said, you know, I want to hear all these good speakers I'm compared to. I've been missing them around town. What he told me, he said, is, if they only could hear you in the caucus and how passionate you are and how you drive the members with the message to urge them on, they'd have a different view, says she in defense of her speaking style.
What do you think of comedian Stephen Colbert and his recurring interview segments with members of the House on the Colbert Report? He often makes these people look like fools. Many of them are Democrats. Do you advise them not to appear on the show?
I don't personally advise them not to, but I publicly say I wouldn't go on any show with a comedian when there's only supposed to be one comedian in the room and it's not live to tape. As long as they're editing it, you can end up saying anything on the show. I don't think anybody has come off looking good on it, although I watch Stephen Colbert almost every night.
Well, he's very funny, but also you get the feeling that these politicians think that they're smart enough to be able to handle him, but they're at a disadvantage.
I remember when I went on the Jon Stewart show, and I had all these funny things I was going to say, and my daughter Alexandra said to me, Mom, and everybody said, there's only one comedian in the room, so don't try to be that person. And I think our members, they are funny, and they have stories to tell. But if you don't have the editing machine at the end of the day, you can really look silly.
Well, I hope you
And not that I don't think they all did a magnificent job when they were on the show.
I hope you appreciate the fact that this was live. Nothing is edited here.
I know.
And we want to thank you so much for being with us today, Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, perhaps the next Speaker of the House. You'd be the first woman to ever
first
be the Speaker of the House?
First woman Speaker, get in there, clean house, throw up the windows, pull back the curtains, let the sunshine in, disinfect, and go into the future.
You heard it here first. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.